I thought it would be fun to start with you at Iowa Writers back in the late 1970s, both sort of personally and professionally. Can you give me a picture of Rita Dove back then?
Oh, dear. Well, I was, now it seems like I was so impossibly young at that time, though of course I thought I was, you know, impossibly old. But I entered the Iowa Writers Workshop. I knew that it had the reputation of being the preeminent writers workshop in the country, and I went there without ever having visited, because you didn't visit university campuses in those days. You simply, you know, went where whatever looked good on paper. And so I remember arriving at Iowa. Of course, I was the only person, the only African American in the Master of Fine Arts program, and but I was kind of used to being the only one. And I was, first of all, stunned by how isolated the place was. I mean, way out in the middle of a state that was in the middle of the country, it seemed. But then also that gave it a kind of a hothouse atmosphere in terms of the creative writing program. There were 50 poets, 50 fiction writers, and who were enrolled in the 2-year program. And there we all were, convinced that we were going to be the greatest. At least many people were convinced they were going to be the greatest. It was the feeling of...
Were you?
No, I wasn't at all. I was really... I grew up with books all around me, mm-hmm. and with parents who did not tell me which book to read. So I could read one day Shakespeare and the next day a comic book. I could read a science fiction short story, you know, in a magazine all afternoon one summer, you know, or something. And then the next day I would read a play by Singe or something like that. But my parents didn't say, oh, that's a good book, you should read that. They just let me enjoy the act of reading. So my feeling of literature, my whole relationship with literature was a very broad one, and one which was, it stretched beyond just American poetry, though I was writing poetry a lot those days. I was also reading, I'd gone to Germany the year before, I had been on a Fulbright, so I had read so much European literature, so much German poetry, and so I didn't feel like there was a greatest to be had, because there were so many great writers, and they gave me pleasure. I just wanted to write the best poems I could. And so when I got into this, it truly was a almost cutthroat atmosphere at that time. I mean, I don't know how it is now, but we got into the workshops, and I didn't realize there was a pecking order in workshops that people chose a certain group to be in, and I was in, I think, one of the big groups, but, you know, that was probably because I was black. But I didn't know that. I just wanted to work with so-and-so, and then there I was. The workshops were quite heady. I mean, people would try to impress the poet, and so they would spout off things like this person and that person, and I didn't know half of the poets they were talking about, so I would just take notes underneath my table, you know, underneath the table. Then I went to the library and got those books out and read their poems. And that way I kind of educated myself while I was trying to write, you know, poetry. In a way, it was the best way to go about it. I'm glad that I didn't know anything about the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And... in time, you know, of course, there were people that I met, and we formed friendships. But later, I remember talking to a few other people, particularly the poets who came in the next year, who were a year younger than me. And there was a Hispanic poet, and there was a Native American poet. And years later, we talked about it, and they said, "Gosh, we didn't know that you were as kind of stunned or terrified of those classes as we were, because we basically kind of kept our counsel and just kind of I would say, I will make one comment per workshop, and then I will let everybody else fight it out.
That's not a good, that's not a bad life plan, you know?
No, it really isn't. You know, I mean, in retrospect, at the time, I mean, it seemed like just a really, really rough way to look at literature. But in terms of life, just in terms of focusing me on what I really wanted to do, what did I really want to do with my poetry? Did I want to play one-up and shit with people? No. What I wanted to do was reach somebody. And to that end, I just needed to listen hard, read as much as I could, take I learned how to take criticism, which criticism seemed real and true and honest, and which ones were skewed and meant to derail me. You know, so I learned that in those classes, and it served me well, I guess, in the rest of my life.
You know, speaking the rest of your life, I was struck when you said make one comment and then let everybody else fight it out, because in 2011, I think that's the right year, you edited the Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry.
Yes.
And you included what one critic described as poets of little or no lasting value. And you commented through Bill Moyers and Company and an essay in the New York Review of Books.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that the one comment you made was the inclusion of those poets. And can you talk a little bit about, am I right, that you're making a comment about poetry when you included them, and what that comment might have been?
Well, you know, the comment, what was so amazing and wonderful in the experience of editing the Penguin Anthology was that I was told that I was going to be the sole editor, and this was, in a certain way, my statement or a statement about what 20th century American poetry was. That meant that, you know, as a sole editor, that also means that in a certain way I am giving my opinion. I'm saying this is how I see it. If you have a whole, you know, committee of people doing an anthology, such as the Norton, it becomes a much more juried kind of event. And so I really wanted to be honest. I didn't want to just say, okay, these are the people I like. But I tried to think of what if people were looking back on the 20th century, what kind of indicators would they see for, you know, centuries to come? And what is the kind of stamp of the century? And that was my sole guide. That meant, of course, it was my guide, and yes, it was my feeling, but I thought that all the people that I included were, in fact, worthy of inclusion. I mean, the statement that was made by that particular critic, I just thought was completely nonsensical. You know, I just thought, you know, this is just silly. They all had substantial credentials already. And one of the things what I found interesting looking at the last decades of the century, because my cutoff point was that this person, all poets in the anthology, all poems in the anthology had to be published by the year 2000. That mm-hmm. was my cutoff date. And what I found fascinating about all the last two decades, is that it's how many more poets of color were being published in those decades.
Mm-hmm.
Now, doing the anthology, I realized this was going to keep going, and it was going to be a snowball effect. And therefore, these younger poets who had just a book out, because everyone in that anthology had at least one book out,
mm-hmm.
that they were going to make a mark. They were just starting up. They had already gotten great acclaim. The way that the literary world was changing was going to turn more attention to groups that had been neglected just massively in the past. And that is part of the 20th century. So that feeling, my statement, I guess, or my one comment was, look at the facts, and look at the way, look at the century as a whole. Do not look at it as a place that you're still living in, because we weren't at that time. And and then that's it. You know, I really felt that if someone picked up this book, an anthology, and looked through it, they would not only have a group of amazing poems, but they'd get a sense of the way in which America grew and transformed itself during the 20th century, because poets do comment and write out of life.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of that, somewhere in some of the reading I did, I came across you talking about our interior lives as a perhaps a kind of running commentary, internal commentary on what we're actually interacting with in the outside world, what's going on around us. And am I understanding that correctly? And
you
are. If so, what's the connection with poetry? Is poetry kind of the voice of that subtext in a way?
I think that's exactly right. I think that poetry is indeed, you know, it is the subtext. It's the conversation we're having deep inside ourselves, with ourselves, as we negotiate the world. And it is that interior life that sometimes we are not even aware of. It's buried so deep. It's the part that you wouldn't dare just blurt out to a stranger. But it's the part of us that actually informs the way we look at the world. Our deepest, utter yearnings. You know, it's like saying if you could wish anything for the world, or if you could wish anything for the way you move through the world, what would it be? And we're like, okay, well, that's impossible. I'm not going to wish that. You know, so you don't even say it. So I think that interior life is truly what poetry springs from.
You know, I was reading. I couldn't read all the poems. You just can't read poetry. Well, I can't read poetry that way. So I tried to sort of, spot read from the beginning of your work through the end. And do you have a copy of the book handy?
I do.
Good. I wondered if you would. I am so impressed about, I guess it's the hard thinking that had to go into the simplicity of your language. And I was, and the specific imagery. And I wondered if you would mind reading, I just loved this, Jiving on 118. Because it was, I just sort of, first of all, it made me want to dance while I was reading it. And it made me feel, I'm even older than you are, and it made me feel young again and out there.
Oh.
You know, took me right there. So anyway, could you read it and just say anything you want to say about this particular poem?
Okay, well, thank you. And I will read it.